Tonight, we have an important show. Tonight, we have an important episode. Tonight, we are talking about David Eden Lane. Of course, and the 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Please share out the show to wherever, to whomever, invite your friends. Okay, welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. So we have a short show for you today. However, I believe an important one. Today, we are going to talk about the man who penned the 14 words. Of course, as you know, the 14 words, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Now, this is, as the enemy would have it, one of the most well-known slogans in white nationalist circles, often referred simply to as the 14 words. It's appropriate that this is Wotan's Day, as you can see from the Wotan's hammer there on around his neck. He promoted this as an alternative to Christianity. Let me go ahead and start the description from the beginning as we wait for people to file in. All right. I'm going to have to start doing the hour-long pre-show, HT. All right. Thinking about doing that, making some sort of like set of mini documentaries almost. All right. Okay. All right. Let's set up some things here. I think to avoid interrupting the content, we will probably wait a little bit and let super chats pile in, and then we'll do them in the middle or at a break point. Okay. Let's get started here. So, all right. Let's see. So, David Eden Lane, he was born in 1938 and lived until the year 2007. He is a white nationalist figure. Let me see if I can get a better picture of him. It's probably better. Pretty cool. I didn't like this one because it's a prison picture, but okay. Yeah, I like this one. This is a good one. I don't know who made it, but it's good. Let's do that. Okay. All right. So he was a key figure in the development of white nationalist ideology, and was, of course, famous for coining the 14 words, a white nationalist slogan. So this is a brief overview here. So he was born in Iowa in 1938 and grew up in a troubled household. He later became disillusioned with mainstream society and gravitated towards far-right ideologies. By the 70s, he was involved in various white nationalist and national socialist groups, including the Ku Klux Klan and Aryan Nations. On the Brutish Wagon. By the early 80s, Lane became a founding member of the Brutish Wagon, dubbed by the media as The Order, a white supremacist terror group, as the system calls it. Skimming over some crap that they wrote that I don't like. So, of course, the Silent Brothers engaged in various activities, including armed robbery, counterfeiting, and allegedly assassination of Jewish talk show host Alan Berg, 1984. Lane was accused of being the getaway driver for Berg's murder, which was carried out by another member of the Silent Brothers, Bruce Pierce. So this is a key point because this is contested. Now, for the system, they've convicted him. They convicted him, sent him up for, I think, 400 years, I believe, if I remember that correctly. That is quite a long time to get for being allegedly a getaway driver. So from what I understand, there is no evidence that he was involved at all. This was an ability to pin this on him. And I think that also goes for Bruce Pierce. I think that they don't think they had a single witness to this. Okay, so let's go into the 14 words. While in prison, Lane became a key ideological figure in the white separatist movement. He coined the phrase, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." This became one of the most well-known slogans in white nationalist circles, often referred to simply as the 14 words. He also promoted an extreme interpretation of Norse paganism called Wotanism, as an alternative to Christianity, which he viewed as weak and universalist. His writings and beliefs have been influential among various far-right groups, including skinhead gangs and national socialist organizations. They say neo-Nazi, but I'm not going to say that. Death and legacy. So David Lane died in 2007 at the age of 68 while serving his sentence in federal prison. Despite his death, his writings and slogans continue to be used by white nationalist and NatSoc groups worldwide. His influence is particularly strong among militant white nationalist factions that advocate for racial separatism and violence. Now, this is, again, I'm reading this from a system description here. Lane was a significant figure in far-right extremism, they say, both as a member of the Silent Brothers and as a ideological propagandist. His legacy remains in white nationalist circles. They say white supremacist. I don't like that. Mainstream society and anti-hate organizations continue to combat the spread of his ideas. Well, I think we all should know that you're not going to fight an idea like that. I don't think that happens. What did Frank say? 6 minus 8 equals 14. I don't know if I'm picking up on what he's referencing. Oh, okay, yeah, at 68, right. His death, his age of death, yeah. Interesting. That's very cosmic. It's very cosmic. All right, wow. It's interesting. BMC 1488, he said, rest in peace, David Lane. Your legacy lives on. That it does, and tonight I'm proud to bring you a... You haven't seen this anywhere. Now, you could find... The bubble water thing was whizzing at me there. You can find the interview that I used to do this. You can find that. But you can't find it like this. I did a lot of work here in the past hour and a half, 2 hours or so, cleaning this up and adding subtitles. And man, oh man, it put the computer to work. The AI type of thing, I guess, that creates the subtitles was really straining because the audio isn't great even when it's reconstructed. But when I cleaned it up, it came out pretty decent. Like, you can actually understand what they're saying. In the original copy, which I should bring up as well, just to give you a kind of compare and contrast there. Compare and contrast. It is wild how much of a difference it makes, actually. It's not good in the original. It's very hard to hear what they're saying. It's very distorted. I don't know who converted over this recording of Meredith Vieira's, I think you pronounce her name, interview of him in ABC in a prison. Now, here's the thing. They didn't release it. ABC thought this is a little too based. Now, as from what I understand, let me get her thing. A little information on her as well. All right, so Meredith Louise Vieira, I'll pull her up as well. We have her. There she is. I picked an image of her younger because this is about a little bit, maybe even a little bit younger from when she did the interview. This is what she looks like today. Okay, but this is, in those days, I guess she would probably look a little bit more like this, somewhere between there at her age now and this. Okay, so this is Meredith Vieira. So she was born in 53, and she's an American broadcast journalist and TV personality. She's best known as the original moderator of the daytime TV talk show, The View. Yeah, so there you go. She also was a host of the syndicated daytime version of the game, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, from 2002 to 2013, and is a co-host of the NBC morning news program Today from 2006 to 2011. As of 2019, she hosts a syndicated weekday game show, 25 Words or Less. Also been a contributor to Dateline NBC, Rock Center with Brian Williams, NBC Nightly News. Hosted a long lifetime television series, Intimate Portrait, from 1994 to 2005. From 2014 to 2016, she hosted her own syndicated daytime talk show, The Meredith Vieira Show. Now, why is this important to even mention? Well, because you're going to hear her speaking to him, but unfortunately, the way they filmed this, it's almost like they never intended to air it, because she's not shown at all. When you see most interviews, they'll pan back and forth, or they'll have dual cameras, one or the other. Holy crap, I saw a ghost. I saw a ghost. Oh, Political Bomb, what's up, man? Oh, dude. I haven't seen that guy forever. Wow, man. Nice to see you. Holy crap. And thank you. God dang. Well, not only are we going to do our best to properly represent this man, but we have someone who knew him in the chat, too, which is all the more excellent to kind of be able to get some feedback and tell us where we've got something wrong if we do. And we'll do our best to do him justice that he deserves. Let me just move some of these windows around here. Major salute to you, man. Major salute to you. Little Birdie told me you're doing a show on one of my favorite men tonight. No pressure. No pressure. No pressure. Well, it's nice to see you, man. I'm glad you reappeared. Reappeared. And it's been a while. Welcome back, indeed. Yeah. Klesha says, thank you for highlighting the founders, Nick, loving this series. Well, I do think this is important. I do think that this is an important thing. I do think that there are new people coming in all the time to this kind of worldview and this kind of ideology and trying to find their place in it. And I'll be honest, when I heard about all of this, when I first learned about all this stuff, I didn't know about it. In fact, one of the first people to tell me about it was this guy. I was not really aware of it. I had heard, you know, rumblings, but I had no idea what the story was. So I think it is important that as people do come into this stuff and they don't really know what it is that they're, where does this come from? They'll hear about the 14. Where does that come from? It's important to kind of have a framework of understanding that there were actual people that came up with these ideas and try our best to kind of get a picture of what they were like and what their life was about, because I think that'll help us understand a little bit more about how it got to be the way it is now. Thank you, Klesha. Salute to you as well. Let's go ahead and get started on some of this. So I made this basically in two parts. So let me do two things here. Let me first show you what the original looks like. Now I had tried to fix the audio on this a while back, but it did not come out right. So this is what it sounds like without it fixed. I just want you to hear so you get a sense.
Everything necessary for survival
as a race. Isn't it your stuff? Stop. The mics pick up every little sound. It's amazing. It's like air conditioning units that you wouldn't even hear.
So it does sound like they're having this interview on a under a launch pad of some sort, under a takeoff area for a helicopter or some such thing, right? So I never would like this. I always wanted to hear what this interview was, but I didn't want to. I wanted to hear what the hell he said, you know. So that's the whole point, right? So finally, I think I've done enough cleaning this up. So fingers crossed, this should have come out as good as I thought it did, and we'll be able to fully understand what he's saying and what she's saying too, because I want to understand what she's saying, and I'm a little bit slightly annoyed that they didn't film this properly as an interview. That is slightly annoying. I would like to see it where it's both of them and two cameras that go back and forth, like interviews typically are done. So that way, you know, you can see. Reading the face is a big part of it. That's why I don't do all my shows like this. Because seeing what people's expressions are, half the communication is here. In fact, even more of it's here, but, you know, can't always get what you want, I guess. Anyway, point being, I would have loved it if they had a proper interview done here, but fortunately, we got enough, and I think we can make it work. So the good thing is, all right, so it didn't work. So let's take a look. So there's two parts to this. First, there's the cleaned up version of that. The second part is after this, I have this that I found that it goes through the 88 precepts. So I think that that's pretty freaking cool as well. So let's go ahead and get started before we have, we still have all the time we need. This is the lady who's speaking to him. Because unfortunately, like I said, she's not on camera. So who is this voice? That's the voice asking him the questions. So let's get started. This is taken, of course, at ADX Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Now, of course, as you see, this was done on August 30th in 1995 in the high security penitentiary. Now, this penitentiary is a real doozy. This is where they go when the system thinks that you are Hannibal Lecter, when they want to really just put you in the deepest, darkest gulag they got. I can get you a little image of what that is all about there real quick before we get started here. This is a notorious prison. I don't know about the violence and all this, because I think it's such a matter of mass isolation that, you know, you probably don't encounter as many of the other inmates. But this is where it is. It's in this inhospitable, hostile, oh, I don't know what they're showing that for. It's in this inhospitable, hostile area of the country where it's very hard to, it'd be very impossible to escape. Let's just do it this way. This might actually be better than me reading it. A little more clear, actually.
United States Penitentiary Florence Administrative Maximum Facility, abbreviated as USP Florence ADMAX, commonly known as ADX Florence or the Florence Supermax, is a United States federal prison in Fremont County, Colorado, operated by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, a division of the United States Department of Justice. ADX Florence, constructed in 1994 and opened 1 year later, is classed as a supermax or control unit prison that provides a higher, more controlled level of custody than a regular maximum security prison, or high security as it is called in the federal prison system. ADX Florence forms part of the federal correctional complex, Florence FCC Florence, which is situated on 49 acres 20 hectares of land and houses different facilities with varying degrees of security, including the adjacent United States Penitentiary, Florence High. ADX Florence was commissioned when the Federal Bureau of Prisons needed a unit designed specifically for the secure housing of those prisoners most capable of extreme violence towards staff or other inmates, as well as inmates deemed too high profile or too great a security risk for even a maximum security prison. The inmates are confined for the most part of the day in single cells, with facilities made of poured, reinforced concrete to deter self-harm, and are under 24-hour supervision. Carried out intensively with high staff-inmate ratios. Function. The institution is unofficially
here suddenly becomes so loud.
All right.
So anyway, but it's a problem resolved. So I'm muted.
Oh God. Anyway, I just wanted to give you a thing about what the prison is like, because it's rough. It's rough. Holikoff also says, I've seen this interview. Really brilliant, man. His books are excellent. Yeah, absolutely. A very important person in this whole thing. I've yet to read all of his books. I've read the 88 Precepts, but not the rest. Frank says, this is at Florence Supermax in the visiting room. Big room. Did you ever get a chance to go there, man? That would be pretty wild. Now, I would assume that the reason they did this, right. This is where they send politicals to break them. I would assume that part of the reason they also put him here is not because the crime to which he's alleged to have committed is so particularly crazy, but so much that I think that they were afraid that the Silent Brotherhood was going to come and break them out, him out, rather. And I don't think that was probably going to happen, but I think they were afraid, especially in the early days that this happened, that he was incarcerated. So let's take another. Let's go ahead and get started here. Wow. Oh, you were there. Oh, wow, dude. I didn't know they sent you there as well. Holy crap. Wow. Okay. All right. Wow. That's very intense. That's very intense. Wow. I didn't ask you too many questions about that, but if you're willing to talk about it, I'd be very interested. It's just I'm sure that's a freaking sore spot. I can only imagine. I can only imagine how insane that would be. Let's see. I think that's probably enough. I want to go ahead and make sure we have plenty of time for the interview. So let's get into it.
For great reason, you know, I'm a condition that you must good. Make a statement. Of your belief. So I'd like to give you the opportunity to do that first.
All right. So, is my belief in teaching as a for any sane white man today, there is no other issue than these 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. These 14 words.
An editorial note. So the subtitles will often be a little bit off, but I think it's better to have an approximation sometimes than nothing. Of course, it's we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. It says security.
Our sacred battle cry and white glory.
Why are those words so important to you?
If there is not a total white revolution, very, very soon, then the beauty of a white Aryan line ceases to exist on this continent and perhaps of this world. Forever.
Why do you say
the current white population of the world is approximately 8 to 10%. Approximately 2 to 3% of the world's population is young white female, that is female of a childbearing age or younger. War media and religious systems we live under promote and sanction the mixing of these last white women with colored races constantly. And your government recognizes white nations, white schools, white organizations, white neighborhoods, and everything necessary for survival as a race.
Isn't it your government
too? Seriously.
Stop, the mics pick up every little sound. It's amazing. Like air conditioning units that you wouldn't even hear suddenly become so loud. And,
all right.
So
that's what that horrible jet taking off sound is in the unprocessed version. It's their air conditioner, I guess, and they have some super sensitive, like excessively sensitive mic going on there or something. Seems like a weird choice. You know, I get a normal shotgun mic. What the heck?
Anyway, but the problem is all, it's your government, too, because of...
You could call me a lot of things, but don't call me any relation to the American government. Your government, if you consider it yours, has traveled this world for 2 centuries, from Dixie to Cuba to Mexico to Grenada, repeatedly to Panama, to a dozen Latin American countries, to Italy, to Germany twice, to Korea, to Vietnam, to Iraq, to the halls of Montezuma, shores of Tripoli, to Waco, Texas, to Whidbey Island, to Ruby Ridge, and hundreds of lesser-known wars, occupations, and assassinations in pursuit of your novus ordo seclorum. Novus ordo seclorum.
Which means?
Well, I think technically the new order of the ages. George Bush calls it the New World Order. It appears on the Great Seal of the United States, which has been around for over 200 years. This traveling murder circus has killed literally tens of millions of people. Very real deal.
This is what he references here. Novus ordo seclorum. The phrase novus ordo seclorum, of course, he's, as he said, New Order of the Ages. He said, as he said, George Bush Sr. calls it the New World Order. Thompson derived the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum from a poem by the Roman poet Virgil. He wrote that the phrase signified, quote, the beginning of the new American era, as of the date of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, which was depicted in Roman numerals at the base of the Pyramid of the Seal.
Destroying the integrity of every race, nation, and culture on the globe in pursuit of this new world order. A few men of honor somewhere are going to have to find the courage to put an end to this evil.
Now, what does that mean, Nathan? You know, they're going to have to find the courage. What are they supposed to do?
This evil has to be ended, or there will never be any peace or harmony on this earth, and my race will not survive.
But again, what does that mean when you say that people are going to have to do something? Are those looking more to a call for revolution, essentially?
Absolutely. Your government has left no peaceful solution to the survival of my race. You used the 101st Airborne to integrate my race in our schools. Racial integration is the euphemism for genocide.
Of course, what he's talking about is the thing that I show all the time, where they literally, at gunpoint, did integration, clearly against the will of the people. I'm not going to spend much time on this. I just want to quickly... So, this is not, what of course he's referencing is that this is not how you do this kind of thing if a people are for it. This is how you force it on a people if you're a corrupt, evil, occupying, white genocidal government. That's what he's referencing.
You use the police to beat the white mothers of South Boston to bloody submission.
Awesome.
When they resist genocide. Your police powers travel to a lonely mountain on top, somewhere far off in Idaho, to murder a woman and her son because they wish to live among their own kind and resist genocide.
He's talking about Ruby Ridge here.
So what answer does an honorable man have?
When you talk about this, I can feel how deeply, I can sense how deeply you feel it just by looking at your eyes and how personal it is to you.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Can you give me a sense of David Lane, the man, and what brought you to this point in your life? A sense of you in terms of your upbringing, your background that led you here.
I don't think it has a lot to do with that. Nature gives everybody, every race, an instinct to preserve their own. Maybe 10 years ago, I wrote a piece of poetry that's been used around the world called 88 Lines. 14 words, and I think maybe a couple of stanzas would be appropriate if you're asking about my equation. They go, are you a child with skin so fair, with eyes with blue or green, and ladies with tresses dark with gold, will never again be seen? This is the dread that haunts my soul. Demands for my last breath and struggle I must to wake my kin to nearby sleep again. There is no higher instinct given the males of any race that preserve the beauty of their women and the existence of their kind.
But I guess what I'm asking you is, there are many people who would call themselves white, if you're inclusive of white race, who would not advocate revolution or who do not believe that the white race is in danger of extinction. You obviously feel that they are very wrong. What is it that brought you to that conclusion?
That's a fair question from somebody that doesn't know anything about this, right? As an average reporter would be, they would not really know much of anything about this. The idea of white genocide is probably something they've never contemplated. especially in 1995, it's something that it was on course for these results. But it was not completely clear that that's what was happening quite yet, even in 1995, in my opinion. I think in 1995, if I recall correctly, I think that the white demographic was still at about 85%. So for the average, what we now call normie, they're not seeing the trajectory. They're not seeing where this is likely to go. They're looking at where it is and they're saying, oh, well, I don't see a problem. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? It's a good question if you don't understand, if you don't know what this is all about. You don't know why anyone would think that or why anyone would see it as urgent. But he's right, especially in men, that is the highest instinct, is to preserve your people, your home, and of course, the future for children. To expect anything different is unnatural.
The field is so passionate.
You almost had to get in with all of my teachings, the richest teachings. humanity as a whole spends their life justifying whatever usually false hypothesis that they are taught as youth, and erroneously believe that they are using rational thought. Your media, for example, uses the term minorities for the 90 or 98% of Bernie, while my race faces extinction. That's the suit. And the masses of people, their thought patterns are simply your media, religion, and their upbringing you teach them.
But you as a child, if I understand what I've read about you, and it is correct, even as a child during World War II, you were sort of rooting for him as a little kid. So you hadn't done all these teachings, hadn't done all this kind of studying at that point, the kinds of things that come with age and wisdom and the amassing of knowledge. So there was something in you from a very early age that was saying, on some level, this is wrong. And that's what I'm trying to get at. That person.
I wish we could get into all some of my religious teachings and some of the ancients and why certain people have a mission for a cause. Whether it's Alexander or Galilee or whoever, there are certain people that do it. And
are you one of those?
My cause is to stop the American murder of the white race.
So he's alluding to the fact that his mission is spiritual or transcendental in nature, that it comes from beyond the material realm. It's not simple as his own personal agenda. It's a higher calling.
But has it been your cause for as long as you can remember?
I don't think I was fully conscious of it. If you've read my work, you know I felt for a long time that there were something terribly wrong in the environment of the country. And I spent a long time searching for who had the power. You want to find out why things happen, you have to find out who has the power. And then I have to find motivations more than anything else to find why things happen. You have to see who benefits.
Have to see what else?
Who benefits? and it took a long time. I went through. If you've read my works, you know I consider the conservatives and right wingers and John Birchers and so on to be the issue. I have very little use for.
So it's very interesting because he's describing that even in his own life, in his own journey, he had to go through the stages. He had to go through the stages. He couldn't just jump to his, current position here. He had to go through the original, mainstream right wing and the John Birch Society and all this stuff, only to find out that they wanted to actually skirt the key issues and avoid the actual root of the problem.
So it was a long search.
But eventually you came down to the point where you determined that the ultimate enemy was the Jew.
Before the term Zionist, I am not at all certain that your run-of-the-mill Jew knows any more about what his leadership does than the run-of-the-mill Catholic knew of the Inquisition 4, 5, and 6 centuries ago. But what cannot be escaped is that the essential PowerPoint of media, finance, industry, religion, law, and politics in America and the once white nations are firmly in the hands of Zionist Jews. And they use that power to mix, overrun, and exterminate my race.
But why would they want to do that?
He said that they use the power. The Zionist occupation government uses their power to mix out the race, overrun the race, and ultimately thereby exterminate the race. That's very accurate and obviously still what's going on. Only today, even at a more extreme and accelerated rate than it was in 1995 and than it was in 1985 and than it was in 1975. So it's exponential, but perhaps that's not the right way to say it. But I guess that is it. I guess it's an increasing curve of speed of how quickly they're increasing white genocide. So Frank mentioned to me that he actually was actually in ADX for a year, and he got to see David for the first time in 9 years, and he said it was a good reunion. So that's pretty cool story. It's a pretty cool story. And I think this thing about being on a path of through all of this information, I think that's entirely natural. I don't think most people can come to, parabolic, that's a good way to say it. I don't think that most people can come to this stuff right away. You got to remember, you got to keep in mind, all of this information, the image in your mind that is what you think of when you think of what the situation is. It's pretty severe. It's pretty extreme. It's pretty terrifying. It's not pleasant. A lot of people have a hard time with it. That manifests in a lot of different ways, but I don't think that everybody can handle it, and I think it's probably very difficult for a lot of people. I know I've struggled with the reality that all of this information is. It's not necessarily a pleasant thought. Now, I think there is a nobility, though, in the natural law mission to protect your own. I think that there is a pleasantness in that. There is a pleasantness in the appreciation of your own racial chain, I think. I'm thinking like the golden chain. There is an absolute beauty and positivity in that. And there is a positivity in the triumphs of your Caucasian white Aryan people over the millennia, really. But the challenges and threats we face are quite dark. Are quite dark. Quite an unpleasant reality. So it takes a lot of maturity, I think, and mental strength to handle that correctly. It's not easy. And I think it would do all of us a world of good to have a little bit of compassion for all each other for the reality of that, that it's not easy to tolerate the ominous, threatening nature of this situation we find ourselves in.
Well, probably have to ask Matt. I can look at the evidence, and it's undeniable. I can't read their minds or know their motives. However, people who are racially mixed, Henry Ford made the statement that there was only just one defense against the Zionists, that's to call your sons back to pride and race. If the people are racially mixed and have no sense of heritage or preservation of their own, they become malleable. Perhaps that's, but you'll have to ask them. The evidence is clear, that's what they're doing. Motives? I can't read minds.
I want to go back to 14 words that you said at the beginning, and we must secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. Was that essentially what the order, the British Wagon, if the term we want to use, what that book was all about?
Yeah, I'd like to make it plain that I'm not qualified, authorized, or even permitted to speak for the individual members of the group.
But is that what you understand?
That's an interesting pushback he has to give there. He's obligated to give there that I cannot. He said, I'm not authorized to speak for the individual members of the group. So, I think that's interesting. I do wonder if anyone was, or if they were still considering each other, even amongst the group, as independent men in every respect. I wonder if they would have thought that okay for Robert J. Matthews to speak for the group had he not been, murdered by the feds. I got something really cool to show you, though. Big thank you to Frank. He shared with us a really awesome picture, actually. Actually, a couple of awesome pictures, but let's just show this one because this is his favorite. This is pretty cool. So this is Frank with David Lane in ADX. Zoom it in there. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool, man. Talk about a rare piece of history there. Wow. You could find so little. I was digging for pictures. I didn't want to do the one of him in the prison get up and all this, because it's not, this whole life wasn't about being in prison. Like, it's an unfortunate outcome, but that's not the whole point of his life, right? So I was looking for, good pictures, and there are a few. Like, there's one of them in the Klan hood, obviously at the Aryan Nations, but there aren't an incredible amount of pictures of him, and I think that's kind of unfortunate given his stature in the history of all of this. Tom repeats the 14 words. He says, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. R.I.P. David Lane." That we must. Quite a slogan. It really is powerful, and it's really a good one because it kind of sums it all up in a very tight thing, or just a sentence. The best slogans, the best mottos. I guess motto is probably better than slogan. Those are concise. It's not paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. It's like that. It's like that. Hail to you, Tom. That's the way it's the best. What an awesome picture, though. Actually, let me have one more here. I'll share them both. I think they're both cool. He said that one's his favorite, but this one is pretty neat, too. That's pretty cool. David was a very tall man. A very, very tall guy. Many people noted that. You can see that in other pictures of him, too. You got to tell me, how tall was he, Frank? He looks like he must be 6'2". Tall doc, tall guy. Wow. I'll put those together just in case later. Let's get back to it. Very cool.
My understanding, you see, I only attended the first of these meetings. And in fact, I was a small player in the group.
That's a caution.
But.
Oh. Okay, so yeah, I got that wrong. So there was a specific hierarchy. There was Bob, Robert J. Matthews, Frank, and Randy E. to speak with the media. Okay, interesting. Frank also clarifies he was 6'2 or 6'4. He's not sure which one. That's a very tall man. He's a very tall man. Wow. That actually makes sense, though. That makes sense that there's a hierarchy, because I know you were what they accuse you of being in charge of their communications, I think is what they accused you of. So yeah, very, very wild.
More than anything else, the group was Bob Matthews. It was nothing but Bob Matthews' combination of nobility, courage, and charisma could have brought together such a diverse, strong-minded group of men. Many of them with, for instance, different religious views in a common cause.
Well, how was he even
I believe Bob Matthews is another one of those destined individuals, if you will. He had incredible charisma and courage, and he understood that when you have a volunteer army, you cannot give orders. But if your men have a certain amount of ability, you lead by leading. So Bob loaded up his version of a Viking longboat in Chevrolet, and he said, I'm going to go raid the enemy. Are you with me? Or are you going to sit home?
And when he said that,
the choice was, if you have man of honor, we go for the brave man. And that's what the breeders right here. Yes.
Do you remember first meeting Bob Matthews?
I don't remember the first meeting. He may have written me a few times. They're back around 88 or something. I'm not sure.
And how would he have even known who you were? Too long ago.
I think I had written articles for various publications, probably, to give my guess.
Articles about?
Politics, religion, American. Some people had a book.
But when he might have written to you, what were you doing at that point? What was your involvement in the movement at that point?
I spent years, should we say, penetrating the little groups in this mythical and non-existent movement. I believe if something has absolutely no validity, if it gets nowhere, if it constantly goes backwards and loses, I wouldn't even give it the name of movement. A movement that has dynamics.
That's interesting. that's very interesting. There is a doubt that we've come to know even more so recently. We've had to come to terms with it once again. We once again had to come to terms with this idea that it might not be quite appropriate to refer to it yet as a movement. It is interesting to see that is an issue that he was facing even back then, and that I'm sure this was something that was not lost on these men. That it's not yet moving.
I found nothing. In all the years and times that I looked, I found
nothing. Nothing with National Alliance, nothing with Aryan Nations, nothing with the other groups that were out there. I would suggest they were part of the movement. You were with Aryan Nations.
I have an association. I have an association of all kinds of groups. I have to find out why nothing worked.
Why none of their efforts worked in you?
I mean, from the entire world, probably the best-known group, Aryan Nations, once a year with luck can draw 300 people. First 300 people go down the local corner and watch some porno movie. That's no movement.
He makes a great point. at the time, Aryan Nations was the best known group in the world in this kind of milieu, and they'd have a meeting once a year, and they could have 300 people show up. He said, but, you know, you can regularly get 300 people to go down to the corner and watch a fucking porno movie, so that's not exactly a movement. That's a fantastic point, you know. I think a lot of people these days, they don't want to hear this kind of thing, but it's true. I mean, it's something we have to face. Let me check this out, actually. I might see which one is better. I actually have two versions of this, because my first video software didn't want to let me put the subtitles. I took it into another one, tried to put subtitles, and they didn't turn out great. So I want to check to see if this first version of the corrected audio is better. 1725. Let's see if this is any clearer. I'm trying to figure out also which one I'm going to post afterwards.
And that's what you were seeing back in the early 80s.
That's what I've been seeing in the so-called right wing. If they're the Ibsen.
Why didn't you think that is? What conclusions did you draw?
Human nature, the media, money. A man, for example, I had a real estate license. Didn't take my real estate license away because I won't work for the murder of my race by promoting integration.
You wouldn't sell loans to blacks.
In white neighborhoods. That's genocide. Always remember, racial integration is genocide. Forced racial integration is deliberate, malicious genocide.
And by refusing to follow the...
You have to do it in every aspect of American life. A white man has to commit treason against the existence of his own kind to even hold a job.
Well, in committing that treason, as you put it, you lost your job.
Correct. That's the price you get to pay. Until white men reattach those parts that make a male and show a little courage, the race is doomed.
No? Okay. I understand when you say for 30 years you have seen no direction to this movement, nothing that would suggest that it even is a movement in your estimation. But just to, if I can focus it in the period of this group coming together, give me a sense of you are then, what you're reaching age of 40, I guess, or just in your 40s.
Yes.
And you're looking around, you are involved with Aryan Nation, but you're looking around and you're not seeing anything being done.
Correct.
And you are convinced that the white race is essentially being eradicated in front of your very eyes and nobody's doing anything about it.
Correct.
Most specifically.
Not only is he right, it's still going on. It's still going on to this day. Frank said he had a better version of the audio. I was wondering if he had it digitized. He gave me one more to share here. This is... they made a, what do you call it? He said it called a Pike's Peak of the, how do you refer to it? He said, a Pike's Peak of the Kindred. He started Pike's Peak Kindred. Nice. Look at that. Very cool. Very cool. That's wild.
Specifically, no white people, the ones you would assume would do something about it.
Yes.
So you're a frustrated man, I would assume, in the early 80s.
That's fine. Loaded word, frustrated.
Well, you pick the word. It is, and I don't want to get into all the possible connotations, but you pick the word. That's what it sounds
like. I keep thinking back. I don't think anybody else had any idea of exactly what he was starting or how he was going about things, but... as I remember, it was September 22nd when he called the meeting, which is the
autumn. Just one second, David. Sorry, is this what? You said that he didn't really know what Matthews had in mind when he called this gathering. You didn't know what was going on in his head, that he had plans?
Just speaking for myself, yeah. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think there was a common feeling that the government means to mix, overrun, and destroy our kind, and a common feeling that there was nothing productive being done in resistance. There was talk, as I remember, about Bob Matthews wanted to create, call it a white basket.
Right, in the early 80s.
Yeah, he wanted to move people into an area around Medley Falls, Washington. But other than that, I just don't remember much about the meeting.
In fact, it's funny, because when talking to Richard Kemp, he told us that at one point there was a poster where he was asked to pose with Hemlock's children, and that's going to be the poster to the American Bastion, because he was quite a handsome young man and with his beautiful children as a way to get interest out there to this, to come into Medellin Falls and creating this.
Well, propaganda is a legitimate part of any struggle.
Absolutely. We'd love to see the poster, but nobody can seem to find it. But he remembers that statement that you know, that there was a real effort made, but as you said, you saw no action within the movement. Well, that nobody was flocking to Medellin Falls either. And my sense, Matthews was fairly disturbed that he didn't get much of a reaction.
Well, it all boils down to money.
What?
If you make a public statement, if you're a white man, of the life of your race, you no longer have a job, and your media comes down like hungry sharks in a feeding frenzy with all the buzzwords.
Yeah, so even at this time, I mean, even in the 80s and 90s, making statements in favor of your race could cost you employment. It's not a new thing. Frank said he might have a better version. So let's see. We're at 20. So I just want to see if I can actually have a better version yet. we're running through all the versions.
First, could read a statement of your beliefs. So I'd like to give you your upbringing, your background that led you here.
That one, it's a little bit clearer, but it's still got the air conditioner going on there. Well, let's stick with this one, I think.
You know, that's close.
Oh, you're a Nazi, a hater, a bigot. And you say, I'm just resisting genocide. You're a Nazi, a hater, a bigot. It's like a broken record. And a bit story. So what's the man to do?
Aren't you also advocating the destruction of others? You say they destroy you.
Have you ever seen any of that in many of my writings? You have never seen one of such things.
Advocating the destruction of others?
Yes. I don't think you have. I said that we must have our own nations with preservation of our own kind.
Can I just read through some of your writings?
All right. Maybe I'm wrong.
But maybe I'm reading into it, but
I want to make a couple of points. I think David Lane has a particular kind of clarity of mind in talking about these issues. And he has an approach that strikes me as philosophical, as not that of a politician or of a pundit or of a zealot or even a rabble rouser or something like this, but of someone that's approaching this from a kind of philosophical realm. And I think that there is an urgency, of course, to all the white genocide aspect, but he does seem to come at this stuff from a philosophical angle. Oh, before I continue, Annie Waffen, salute to you, Annie Waffen. She says, I appreciate your work on the founders, Nick. Well, thank you, Annie Waffen. I'm glad you're enjoying it. I think it's important.
Wotan, and that's your name for the armed party, Willibarian Nation.
Correct.
Wotan is ruthless, mature, capable, self-motivated, silent, deadly, and able to blend into the masses.
Correct.
Wotan has a complete revolutionary attitude. He's loyal to those who share his cause. All others are expendable.
That's correct.
Doesn't that suggest that?
No, that doesn't mean you go out and attack them. the trigger, if you go on into that article or into all of my writings, you'll find that the enemy I've repeatedly stated is those of our own race to be treason.
Longknife points out that Charles Lindbergh talked about people losing their jobs in 1941 if they said, quote, Nazi-friendly things, unquote. Yeah, this has been a tactic they've gone after people with for a long time, and it's an attempt to starve people out. It's an attempt to inflict enough pain and suffering on you that you go, oh, okay, fine, I was really wrong, I swear. I love equality and all that stuff now. Yes, this is what the point is. It's to inflict a suffering on you that has an existential element to it, where you know you're afraid, and through that fear, they hope you'll submit, and most people do. So it's a technique that's developed. I don't know. I'd like to know when it started. I'd like to know when it started because it's long before the World Wars. Well, I'd like to know when this began, because it probably is even longer than that. David Lane have children? That's a good question. It's a good question. I believe he did, but I'll find out.
But when you say expendable, what is that?
That means that in a war, there are usually innocent victims. Always have been. It's unfortunate, and we didn't ask for this war. But we're not going to accept the murder of our race because they're going to be innocent victims in a war.
But you're not even suggesting they're innocent victims. You're suggesting, and you're looking around. You are involved in their initiative, but you're looking around and you're not seeing anything being done.
Correct.
And you are convinced that the white race is essentially being eradicated in front of your very eyes, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Correct.
Most specifically, no white people, the ones you would assume would do something about it.
Yes.
So you're a frustrated man, I would assume, in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a loaded word, frustrated.
Well, you pick the word. It is, and I don't want to get into all the possible connotations, but you pick the word. That's what it sounds like.
Let me think for a little while.
Okay.
So Frank described Dave as... Frank described David as a poet, a philosopher, and a seer for as long as he knew him. Wow, okay. No, he did not have children, by the way.
If a man watches the death of his race, he's sad. I don't know if he's frustrated. I suppose that's a good metaphor.
Angry?
That kind of anger to be a... non-productive emotion, the real truth. I get, once in a while I get angry if I start talking about the federal government. But I'm very understanding. So I don't get angry. I'll tell you an incident. One day I was with Bob Matthews in a major city that will have to go unnamed, and we saw a little... white girl get off of a school bus with a couple of little black boys. And they're fooling around in some sexual horseplay or something. And Bob Matthews immediately, I'd like to shoot her right now.
Shoot the little girl?
Yes. Well, she's the one committing treason.
By doing what?
By betraying her race. That's Bob Matthews' way of doing it. I said, no, Bob, that's not right. From the time she was a tiny baby, her preacher, her teacher, her school, her religion, her newspapers, her television, every possible sensory stimulation said, the most noble, wonderful thing you can do is mix your race out of existence. And you're going to expect this little girl to make a moral judgment about whether that's proper. I'm not angry. I'm sad.
Well, if Bob would have shot him, wouldn't you?
Bob would. Now, that's just a gut reaction. The males of every race and species are given an instinct by nature to preserve their own kind. There is a natural antipathy put between every race and species in order to preserve the individuality and existence of each. And the males are supposed to defend the existence of their own kind. So there's anger. It's understandable. I look at it in a little bit bigger picture, and I don't see anger as productive.
Going back to that time when you said you were sad and and you saw no tangible evidence out there that anybody was doing anything.
Correct.
That's a correct observation he made, though. It's no wonder he's spurred to action, because he looks around and no one is doing anything. You know, and this is something that I think a lot of our young men feel to this day. That they look around and they see nothing. They see no organization. They see no leaders. Most of our men are placated with the distractions that our overlords and genociders have designed for us to keep us focused on anything but our actual race existence situation. Sports, drugs, girls, anything at all, anything but that. Career, travel, internet, on and on and on and on and on it goes. Like any kind of distraction but to face the existential threat. Anything else. So it's no wonder you have these concerns as you look around and you see nobody doing anything about it. And there is no organization or individuals that the system will tolerate that actually are doing anything about it. If there is a group or individuals that emerge to do something about it, the system comes down on them with everything it's got, time and time again.
Is that when Bob Matthews came into your life?
No, I've always run my own. I go my own way. When I found out what was going on, I set out on a program to distribute. Hopefully, I meant to distribute a million pamphlet that I had designed called "The Death of the White Race" to as close to every household in colored Africa as possibly could. Bob just happened to pick my name when he picked his sad foot to group together. So I was there, and I don't remember much about the meeting, what was said, but obviously it must have been in accord with my 14 words, or I wouldn't have gone along with it.
Why do you think Bob Matthews selected you as one of the initial members of this group he was gathering together?
Or the line of Bob Matthews. I don't know. Bob was kind of like, he was a mystic all-around man. He was deeply involved in history, heritage.
And if people fail you in treason,
well,
then your treachery will be appropriately rewarded. That's not innocent victims.
You're not innocent if you commit treachery. You have to look at the whole, everything has to be put in context. Don't just take one sentence. Those who commit treachery. And then I go on to deep. Some of that treachery is learned.
Well, and I'm just taking excerpts right now.
Right.
What I'm saying is, when you talk about those who commit treason,
what's the penalty for treason?
Be aware.
What did your country do to somebody?
Appropriately rewarded.
What does your country do to somebody that it deems has committed treason? They're expendable, aren't they?
Well, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying when you use the word expendable, to me that suggests that you are advocating the...
How can somebody of another race commit treason against my race? It must be logical. Only my race can commit treason against my race. And they deserve what they did.
Including death.
The penalty for treason. What's the penalty for treason in the laws of their country?
So you do real.
So that makes sense, of course. You can only commit treason as an insider. You can't commit treason as an outsider. As an outsider, you're just an enemy. Right? So that, of course, that makes sense. Yeah, the penalty for treason on the books of the United States is supposed to be death. Now, when's the last time the United States government sentenced an actual traitor to death? I don't. The Rosenbergs, I guess, it's probably been about that long. It's clearly a law they don't use. It might not be. It might have been more frequent or recent than that, but it's not used a lot. I would speculate the reason that they don't sentence too many traitors to death is probably because they know that that would apply to a lot of them. And they know that it would be just a matter of time before the power changes hands. And maybe it's going to fall back on them. And they don't want to take that risk. That's what I would speculate.
Your writings advocate killing those who would commit treason.
With a proper trial. Just like you do in your country.
What's the proper trial?
If there's evidence, if the evidence is clear, if the evidence is clear, you commit treason. There's nothing.
And who decides on the evidence? Who's the jury?
In revolutionary times, you do not get the same kind of, look at revolutions. There's innocent people in revolutions, but once again, the choice is, do we sit back and let you exterminate our race, or do we fight? No choices. We left no options.
So you don't advocate the removal then from the face of the earth of the enemy beyond those who would commit treason, i.e. white people. And you're not advocating the removal of Jews or people of color.
What do you mean by removal?
Well, Matthews referred to it as bribing the enemy.
Whether you want to believe that there is a motive force called God that created the separate races on separate continents, or if you want to believe that they are the result of nature on separate continents, that was the plan. Imperialism is always wrong. Mixing is part of imperialism. Doesn't matter whether this Alexander's Empire, whether it was the Moorish Empire, the attacked Europe, the Genghis Khan's Empire, you blend different races, you have war because each is given a nature, ordained instinct for self-preservation.
And if more people die.
Great job. But whose fault is it?
This also sort of seems like a sensibility of the modern person, where there is a mentality of a guarantee to life, that your survival is something that is guaranteed. That's pretty weird, if you think about it. What do I mean by weird? I mean that it is out of sync with most of human history. Almost all of human history. Probably a better way to say it. Nature doesn't guarantee the survival of any species of creature. It just doesn't. So it's really weird for us to think that we are sort of like entitled to live. It's out of step with the rest of nature, is my point.
It's Genghis Khan's fault because he had to go from Mongolia to Europe. It's the Moors' fault because they had to go from Africa to Europe. It's Caesar's fault because he had to go all over the world. It's Xerxes' fault. But it's not the fault of the victim. I try to tell that constantly when I see her person.
This is the producer.
Try to tell that, yes, you can.
When I see young white men and young black men at each other's throats, they send them to school together, and of course there's competition for girls. So they hate each other. That's not the fault of the black man. That's not the fault of the white boy. That's the fault of that filthy federal judge that tries to mix and destroy what God or nature created.
So what do you do with the filthy federal judge?
Oh, there, what I was talking about. A short trial and a shorter rope with a long drive.
Straight to the point. A short trial, shorter rope, and a long drop. He's right. This is what I was kind of harping on this the other day, that like for all these issues we have, for all these threats that we face, so many of them would not be an immediate problem if they were not enforced via the authority of the federal government. Without that authority handcuffing our actions, there's very little of these problems we could not solve. In fact, I don't think there's probably any of these problems we could not solve. But it is exactly that handcuffing where they more or less kind of have us all as almost like hostages, where we can't, so we're subjected to terrible things, things that threaten us as a group, our future existence. But should we do any actions to try to prevent that? So, if you think about it, it is kind of like a hostage situation of sorts, isn't it? You're not allowed to leave, but they won't treat you right if you stay. You know, it's pretty messed up if you think about it, right? It's kind of like when you have a ton of diversity come moving into your neighborhood, right? If you leave, that's white flight. Oh, that's implicit racism. If you organize to try to push them out, well, that's, I mean, for nowadays, I mean, yeah, that's intimidating the minorities, right? And prison for you. If you, you're damned if you're doing, you're damned if you don't. There's really no, they're creating a situation you're boxed in. And they've been doing this for a very long time, where it's always a no-win proposition. It's only degrees of how much you're losing, because there's no actual, like, correct answer. It's only how much bad are you going to have to tolerate?
They destroy what God or nature created. And for that matter, if your cause is a political state like America, they destroy it. Cannot put the males, let's back off them. Your nation puts more people in prison than any country on earth. Your country puts more people in prison per capita than anybody on earth. Your country executes more people by far than any Western nation. And still the biggest growth industry in this country is prisoners. It's doubling in less than 10 years. Are you going to lock up half the population or assassinate half the population to prove that you can mix and destroy what God or nature created?
Dr. by the same token, are you going to assassinate half the population to prove that you shouldn't?
You don't have to. You simply have to obey the laws of nature. You simply have to understand the instincts given every race and species to preserve their own kind. Then all the conflict is over and there is harmony.
But if I understand correctly, and you need to help me out on this, the conflict will only be over if you stop the next race. If you
correct. When every race, nation, and culture on this earth is permitted to pursue its own destiny and its own sacrosanct territorial imperative without interference from religious or political imperialism, there will be harmony.
So you're willing to live in peace, but you want to do it on your own little piece of land and have nobody else tell you what to do. You don't care about... If you had a little tract of land that was just white people, that would be okay, and everybody else...
Not a little tract. It takes, over a long period of time, every race has had its own continent.
He's talking about the territorial imperative. He's talking about how we should all be allowed to have our own... our own place on this planet, and how this conflict doesn't need to be. It really never needed to be. Oh, wow. Frank mentions, let me actually make sure that's okay to talk about. Mr. Baum, he said, what we need is a preference cascade, a situation in which people's private opinions reach a tipping point and become publicly expressed and accepted. Once people feel free to express, they realize that everyone around them feels the same way. Then you can start making the changes we need. I fully agree. Fully get it. Yeah. Yeah. It's it's the courage is contagious thing, right? Once a few people are courageous enough to express what they really think, then other people feel safer in doing it. But usually, there is sort of like a critical mass of sorts, I guess. It's usually not just two or three people. Usually, it's who knows how many it is. It's probably a particular number. It's probably over 50%, whatever that is. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a little bit under 50%. I know that once enough people started to express a lot of these opinions, they absolutely would feel like, oh, wait, you all think that too? I've been thinking that forever. I was just afraid to say something about it. That's going to be the reaction for a lot of people. That's what it's going to be like. And they're going to have felt like they were hostage for a long period of time. I will say, no matter what, though, it will be a real... you know, it's kind of like a dam breaking, right? At first, it's just a little spurting of water, and then it gets bigger and bigger, and then it's really coming out like a fire hose, and then it spreads, the hole in the dam gets bigger and bigger, and then eventually the whole thing just crumbles. That's exactly what it will look like. Preference cascade. I don't have to remember that terminology. It's a great term, I guess, for it, yeah. Preference cascade. I think you'll find out that the preference for a lot of these views, specifically separatist views, it's a lot more widespread than we want to believe.
The inevitable result of propinquity or integration or whatever term you want to call it is genocide to Mexican.
But what continent are you couldn't get?
Pardon?
What continent are you going to get? Because that implies you have to throw people off it. What do you think?
Migrations are part of history.
Forced migration. That's what you're
for different reasons.
But what
all kinds of migrations, with tribes and races.
What continent are you talking about?
To begin with, Europe has to be where it always was. Africa has to be where it always was. Asia has to be where it always was. This unspeakable monster you're creating in America, I don't know what you do with it. I think the best that could be done is what some people call balkanization.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. He said, I think the best that can be done is balkanization. Wow. That is very interesting. Obviously, we know a lot of people that are very pro. They're hoping for balkanization to go well and to result in us getting our own territory, our own racial living space, Lebensraum, right? There's a lot of people that are waiting for and hoping for that. Billy Roper being one of them. I know that Billy corresponded with David by pen pal. He's made that. He's talked about that a number of times. Thank you again, Political Bomb.
What is that?
Great point.
The country will have to be divided. I'm going to get a group on
that. Then you're comfortable with that.
I think that, it's the only choice. I mean, it's that for ongoing, so you put half the people in the country in prison, or so you're successful in murdering migration. You don't have a choice.
I want to go back to the Dallas that off that, and I don't want to end this conversation. I want to pick it up again, but because this is obviously something that you care deeply about and continue to grow and believe in. But to go back to that meeting, you know, where we left off, you had said that you didn't know the specifics of what was going to happen. You had sort of described Matthews to me. Was he, when he talked about his race, was he a passionate man?
Oh, yes.
In what way? How did he?
I don't know. You could sense that if Bob Matthews said, he told me early on, I don't remember when, that he figured that he would be going to war with the Federals and he would probably last year. And essentially they're saying, I'm going to die in combat with these people, if you want to call Federals people. But you could tell Bob Minnie and what he said in the past.
You just knew when he said it. Wasn't
you knew when Bob Matthews said something, he's taking life from it.
Because there was a lot of rhetoric in the movement again of that time. In fact, another member of the group had said that people were starting to get impatient because everybody was talking, we have to do this, we have to do that, but nobody ever did anything. And there were some impatient young men out there, Matthews being one, who felt, let's just do it.
I think so. But Bob was the king. He was the king. He's the only leader the Brooder ever had and ever will. I think so. But Bob was the king.
The only leader the Brooder ever had and ever will. Interesting. That's an interesting point. It does seem you'd have to ask why is she doing this interview though, right? If they're not even going to air this. Could it be that they're just, you know, building a psychological profile on him? It seems like that would be the way to go. You get an interview. You ask him to expound on his ideology, on his upbringing, on his past, on his motives. And that way, you have a total psychological profile. And you don't have a white coat going in there to, you know, to look like a doctor. No, instead, you do it like you're a reporter. Specifically one like this. You know, she's gotten older. But, you know, she wasn't terrible looking when she was young. She was probably, you know, you're in prison. Well, a pretty woman, you know. Prison. You know. So your daddy is a man, you're likely to be a lot more forthcoming talking to a woman, a decent looking woman, than you would be to some, you know, large-nosed doctor being sent in to do that.
You know,
pretty disingenuous, for sure.
The only leader the Brooder ever had, never will. There's no words for Bob. He's just a special, noble man.
And what do you think he was able to touch in this book, man? Because you really were very different people from different backgrounds.
Boy, I don't know how to put the exact words on what causes leadership ability. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how to define charisma. Yeah. He's just a dynamic. Noble gray young man. Put it this way, if you had four daughters, you want all four of them married.
He was that kind of man,
too. I think he's the finest man that ever walked this country. I think no countries.
Because?
Because I love him like a brother. That's all I can say.
But what makes him angry?
Man that has principles, a man can die for his principles, a man who loves his brothers. You know, in the kind of system we have today with its hierarchies, if a man is a general or a colonel or a higher up, when they come to the battleground and it's bedtime, the colonel sleeps in the tent on the cot and the soldiers sleep on the ground. You were traveling.
Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, when he doesn't emphasize his words, it's lost on the audio. I was hoping that, you know, it would pick it up in the cleaned up copy, that I could get accurate subtitles for this, but it's still kind of lost. I hope someday somebody finds a really clean, pristine copy of this recording that's not all kind of, you know, I hope that's found.
I mean, in an action somewhere, and you took a motel room and packed a bunch of guys in, Bob would say, "Guys, take the bed. I'll sleep on the floor." And it's a whole personality thing. It's just, you're just a noble, brave, wonderful man.
Yeah, another member of the group said the kind of guy who gave you the shirt on his back.
It sounds like he's describing, you know, the psychology and soul of Bob Matthews. What he's describing is a person who is self-sacrificing and somebody that's willing to put their own interests behind the interests of another, or of the group as a whole. That is rare, as a rare personality type.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Which, I suppose, some would say doesn't play with what happened afterwards, and others would say what happened afterwards is proof. You know, depending on where you come from.
There's the rabbit thinks the coyote's a bad guy for wanting to eat him. Coyote thinks the rabbit's a bad guy for wanting to run away. Everybody has their own perspective.
How much of an influence do you think Gordon Fall was on what eventually transpired in Medellin Fall?
I think Gordon Fall had an impact, particularly on those who followed the Christian identity. Yeah, that's but I find it very important. I have strong disagreements about the way some of these people in the quote movement have gone about things. But the purity of their motives and that some of them stand for their beliefs, you admire that. Admire that.
But why do you think that what happened to him motivated people to do more or set the tone of what happened?
The propaganda of the deed is always 1,000 times more effective than just chatter.
Mm-hmm.
People are motivated by it. They're not motivated by words.
So when Gordon Call was killed, that gave people a reason to want to do more than talk about revolution.
One of the founding fathers says that freedom has to be periodically, grounds of freedom have to be periodically watered with the blood of martyrs or some such statement. I don't remember exactly.
I think it's the tree of liberty must from time to time be refreshed with the blood of martyrs and patriots, I believe. Out of my head. It's funny because you get a lot of these patriot types, and they don't seem to remember that part, right? That part always seems to escape them. But it's really useful to reiterate this, that this is founding stuff. This is stuff the country itself was founded on. It's kind of a good thing to bring it back to, too, because when framed in that sort of way, the parallels are pretty clear.
That's fact.
And that's what Paul was, and not
everything. Yeah, I think so. His sons are his son, and the origin Scott Powell did absolutely nothing but be targets for the federal assassins, and they threw him in prison the rest of their life. They did the same thing, you know, with Randy Weaver. The family were nothing but targets for federal assassins, and afterwards they tried to put Randy in prison for the rest of his life. Along with Jerry Spence managed this to stop that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was after Call's death that the rally was down at Aryan Nations, or in Spokane, sponsored by Aryan Nations, and that's where Matthews... Apparently, I don't know if you remember this. He stood up to the crowd. There was some anti-rally.
I've seen the picture.
Yeah. And right. Basically said, let these people talk. I came here. Several people who were with him that day said they saw a leader being born at that moment, that he impacted on those around him who didn't know who the heck Bob Matthews was. But he did something very simple. He stood up.
Very good.
That's what they said.
Very good. Maybe you just get on your own question and answer your own question. He did something. That was Bob. He just looked at a situation, said if nobody's doing something, then I'll do it.
And that was what he wanted to hear.
Not me particularly. I never felt something. It wasn't until after the whole events were over and had gone to trial and all of these things that I began to realize just what a magnificent man the feds had killed up with the other.
You didn't realize that before? You didn't realize exactly what he had been involved in before?
It was a growing process, I guess. Bobby grew on you.
He grew on
you. He just grew on you. I had spent a long time, but you run out of superlatives. He's just a wonderful man, that's all.
Can you take him back to September 22nd? You said it was the, what did you say, autumn?
I think it was the autumn equinox. And I think it was the 22nd of September. I just don't remember much about it. Contemplating it afterwards, and knowing that Bob was into kind of a mystical sort of heritage and whatnot, I'm sure that's why the date was picked, and he gave some kind of a little talk, if I remember right.
What did he do? I'm not saying that you all came and had sort of a potluck dinner with wives, family, and then men retired to the barracks, or what was known as the barracks?
I think that's what happened, yeah. I wish I could help you, but I just... That's 12 years ago, and it at the time, it made no real impression on me. I didn't really become impressed with the rest of the what's been called the Bruder's Hall until the trial. And I heard the allegations of the Federals, and I saw 10 men standing strong in the face of 1,000 years in prison, and in the face of the murder of their leader, and I became very impressed with this bunch of great men.
Do you remember, though, at the time, do you remember the chairs in the circle? Do you remember? I'm just trying to get a sense.
There were chairs in the circle, and some pledge, and some talk by Matthews, if I remember that. And then there was a baby put in the circle, and they pledged to fight for a future for white baby, for white children, I guess.
Was the baby doing anything? It was a little girl.
I'm glad you told me. I don't remember. This wasn't only in retrospect.
But I would think, given the sense of zeal and mission that you all had, that it would resonate very strongly.
It wasn't there at that time. This was all apparently something came later. At least, This was a bunch of guys who got together and talked about, we got to know some people in Marvin, up in that area, and try to preserve our town. There was no hint of what would come.
There was no suggestion that, you might be involved in illegal activities, talk of robbery or...
Well, none whatsoever. In fact, there was talk about getting a contract to clear forest trails or something, if I remember right. That's the only conversation. Don't get me wrong. It's not that I have any... I wish we could have come up with some way to raise an army and march on D.C. or something. I have no objection to that. I don't believe there was any conversation at that time.
Do you remember any conversation about an assassination?
None whatsoever.
No discussion about counterfeiting? I've read accounts where you actually brought up the whole idea of why don't we try counterfeiting?
I don't think Matthews asked you to look at any discussion at that first meeting ever. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I wouldn't swear to you, but I don't remember anything but just a bunch of guys saying, we got to move some people up this white bastion.
Was it at all an emotional meeting with them?
No. But not, I didn't notice it that time. I wish I could make something like that for you because
it's interesting because others have said that people can have different takes on the same event. One man described it as Hallelujah. That doesn't mean that that's his perception. Yeah. Right? You seem to describe it as sort of void of emotion. It really wasn't.
Well, I consider the young men who were the action men of the Bruder's fighting to be the finest, most noble men on the continent. But they didn't begin to grow on me until later when I actually saw what they were doing. So Maybe I was jaded or something.
Who were they in terms of the ones that were in that initial group? Who did you think were the fine soldiers that you were holding?
Well, I can't co-sign allegations made by the federal service. Some young men that Bob Matthews brought. If some of them have admitted to you that they were there, then fine. Like I said, I didn't get 190 years for talking.
Well, Richard Campbell didn't was there.
If you did, then you know.
I don't know your perception of him. I know that he said he was there. Would he be one of those fine young soldiers you're talking about?
Well, when I see the evidence that said he was there, I'll tell you. I'll tell you this. Richard Kemp is one of the finest young men I've ever met.
You have an impression of Deborah Corbett? I'm talking back then.
I'm drunk.
Even at that time?
Absolutely.
What about Ken Moore?
Did I see Ken Locke was there?
Gee, I don't know. I don't think so. I guess that's your impression.
I guess we can talk about Ken Locke. He's one of the traitors, huh?
Fables.
Oh, we got great tapes.
Yeah. Ken Locke.
I kind of like Ken Locke. I could see he had some character defects and weaknesses, but I kind of like Ken Locke. I think I still do, even though he's one of the three that brought your perjured testimony that put me away forever. I'm not a vindictive person, you know. When the Federals come to some of these guys and said, we're going to put you in prison forever, we're going to put your wife in prison, we're going to take your kids away and give them to who knows who. I'll let you talk. Each man made a decision for the big money. Comrades, my family. And Ken made his decision.
Well, you know what he said to us. He made the decision to basically lead them to you.
Well, he's the one that trapped them.
Because he thought that at least that would save your life, that he was afraid that you would die. He actually described you as a nice man.
No justification there, but...
Well, this is the thing now. He's allowed his...
Yeah.
You're
I understand.
You got to allow everybody their own point of view here. His point of view was that you were going to die if you didn't do it, and... He stands by everything he said. He has never suggested that he was coerced in his statements. That's his view, that he told the truth about you. And when you testified about your involvement, it wasn't the truth.
There is absolute proof that he and another guy testified. He that I was on the West Coast and another that I was on the East Coast. The same weekend, riding the same yellow Volkswagen.
So they don't have any witnesses to this crime. They put him in prison. Without witnesses. That's pretty wild. It's pretty horrible. I suppose just on testimony. That's pretty horrible. Jay Reaction says, I noticed earlier that instead of interrupting him, asking leading gotcha, loaded questions, etc., she immediately shuts up and lets him talk like a therapist or interrogator. I think you're right. P.S., good on you for this great work as always, my man, 07. Well, 07 to you, Chain. 07 to you. Baum said, in reference to this case, the Department of Justice said this was the first time that the 16-year-old racketeering law had been used in a political case. Yeah, so I was always under the impression that they had some sort of deeper evidence of this, of this alleged crime for which they put him in the gulag forever for. No. Apparently not. That's really horrible. That's uniquely horrible.
But it's my word against his. All these federal perjurers, that's one thing. When the evidence is absolute, they're lying. I'm not going to get into some debate.
Yeah, and I do want to go through some of the evidence in a little bit, but I just bring that up because he did talk to us about it, and you say you still think you kind of lied about
that. I think it was weak. I think the federals went going and said, see, I don't mind him rolling over and testifying. What makes me mad about these guys is when the feds make up stories and they'll testify not about what happened, but any story that makes me mad. That makes me very unhappy. But I still, Locke made his decision, Locke his family. And he's certainly not an evil man like the feds that destroy my race.
Does he deserve to have his head cut off, which was the penalty that the group had determined would be netted out to those?
If that's what the group determined, I didn't have any decision. If I had no decision made. If I had something to say about it now, I can. If I had my own country right now, if I was president of this country, which would be the first good president you ever have, it's part of David Lane for president of the United States.
Who's going to go for that?
With your media help, about 65% of the population.
You think so?
Oh, actually. Once the American, if I ever break your media barrier, they would all go by there. If I could ever, if I had 1 hour on your national TV, people my philosophy.
Wait, I'm sorry.
I'll tell you, I'm sorry, what were you saying? If I had 1 hour on your national TV, with props, without interruptions, turn the world upside down.
That's all it would take is 1 hour?
That's all it would take to get the ball rolling, so to speak. The average person has never had. The average person in this country has never been exposed to any truths in their entire life.
But your literature and the literature of like-minded people is out there. Some might argue that the average person has been exposed and has discounted it.
No.
If it's the truth, why has...
Just a minute. You'll find no relationship between my literature and what you call the right-wing or conservatives. I consider the likes of a Rush Limbaugh to be the worst enemy my race could ever face. You find, and even in the white mythical movement, I don't think you find much relationship between what I teach and they teach.
But the ultimate goal is this. Within that white, as you call it, mythical movement,
maybe it is. I can't read the minds of these people. I don't know why. If you could have been privy to what I've been through for 20 years, 30 years total in the so-called right wing, and seen the absolute insane idiocy of these people. You have to know. Maybe the movement, so-called, was run by the enemy. I don't know. They have fantasies out of them. You ever heard of a guy named Jim Woodson?
It's actually kind of funny. I mean, I have to laugh about this because it's the same shit. It's the same fucking shit. If you didn't laugh, you'd cry, right? Because it's so fucked up, but it's the same shit. It's the same people. It's the same people with the same concerns. And what he's talking about, this is like 50 years ago, and there was no actual organized sanity then, and there's no organized sanity now. And he's talking about, like, the absolute fucking idiocy that you... these people... Yeah, I mean, dude, it's the same thing. Like, he could be talking about, like, today. He could be talking about 2024 and 2025 because it's the same exact crap. It's like the... I don't know what it is about the far right or whatever you want to characterize it or... I mean, white nationalism, I guess, but I don't know whatever you want to call it. Dude, like, why is it like this? You know, like, why the fuck is it like this? You know, it's painful because you know it should be better. You have this great history of all these powerful people, and yet... Why is it that today no one can get it together? We have to, like, sit around and speculate as to why. Because it's kind of... kind of mind-boggling, really. You'd think somebody would, like, trip and accidentally get it right once, right? But he's absolutely right. I mean, he might as well just be saying this today because it's the same exact shit. This is 50 years ago. Well, this is 1995, but he's talking about approximately 50 years ago-ish from today. So, why? Like, why is it like this? I mean, he's giving this interview 30 years ago, but... being like, how come nobody can get it together? They've never gone after any other group of people in the same way. That I think that's fair. That might be part of it. I mean, that might be a big part of why, if we really think about it. I think that is definitely a part of it, because there's no other group that has... been targeted by the powerful, largely Jewish overlords in the same way that we have. And it's not just them. It's there are intermediaries in the federal government that are deployed to disrupt and infiltrate and poison and lie about and stir up and slander and attack and just cause absolute chaos at every turn. That's probably a big part of it. It's probably a big part of why. Redundant as fuck. Yeah, well, it seems to be a big part of why. Like, you got some retard coming in my chat being like, why do you have a kippah on your thing in this stream? I've never touched a kippah in my life. Much less did I own one. They saw some, I don't know, they saw some, like, circular object. Like, oh, it's a kippah. No, I've never even touched one of these. Like, as in, no Jew has ever handed me one. Like, here's my kippah to look at. Check this out. Never seen it. Never touched it. Don't want to. Want nothing to do with the fucking thing. Never even seen one in real life. Ever. I don't even know if I've ever seen one on one of their heads in real life. I haven't seen that many Jews. But it's this kind of shit, right? It's a perfect example. You get some retard spreading lies, making shit up, turning people against each other. And for what reason? Like, for what fucking reason? Like, you know, the only way I can think of for that is that it's great at making everything chaotic. It's great at disrupting and distracting and derailing things. And that's what they've been doing for 50 fucking years. Probably more than that. Well, I don't know. Probably even before 45. Because somebody was mentioning earlier that, you know, even in for Lindbergh in the 40s, he's talking about people getting fired for saying things that were too approving of the Nazi side of things, right? So I think this has been going on for a very fucking long time.
He made up fantasies about how 200 million Mongolian horsemen were riding their steeds across the Alaskan tundra to attack America. Another one, a retired colonel, had some fancy about millions of Mexican and communists hiding in tunnels when you're attacking them. It's kind of insane, isn't it? But don't accuse me of having anything to do with this right wing or even the right wing. It was time for something new in it.
But then that would suggest that the movement is pretty powerless in your estimation.
Boy, you said it for me. Thank you. There is no movement. That's the reason that, excuse me, that's the reason that I, with the help of Tatchett, try to run things in a manner which historically has proven has a political chance of success.
What are you doing that's different?
Well, I can tell you little bits of it. First of all, anybody that understands the motivation, how to motivate people, know what you get on a single issue. And you beat it to death. First of all, anybody that understands the motivation, how to motivate people, know what you get on a single issue, and you beat it to death.
Mm-hmm.
They know that issues have to be emotional. They know, I don't want to get into all the things that I do, but.
But is the issue that you're beating to death of the white race is doomed unless people do something about it?
Absolutely. 14 words.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people call me Mr. 14 words. Mm-hmm. There is no other issue. And I'm going to beat that to the day I die.
Well, you think about it, he's right. You think about it, he's right. There is no other issue. Because all other issues are underneath that issue. Like, if that issue was the star on top of the Christmas tree, as it were, it's the top of the pyramid. Every other issue is underneath that issue. Because if your people aren't secured, if there is no future, then who cares about all the other issues? Do you really care how it goes for the non-nons, I guess, if your people don't survive? Does anybody care? Like, I don't care. I care about how the world looks in 100 years. If we're in it. If we're not in it, I don't give a fuck. You know, and any other kind of like minutia kind of all stems out of first existing and having a future.
And why don't you think that the white race is feels beating about to what? Well, and
everybody is starting to believe you me. The entire bunch of these, whatever they are, are coming my way, and they will.
What do you mean, the entire bunch of whatever they are?
The ones that see 200 million Mongolian horsemen riding. They're going to finally figure out that whoever it is that's been running things is either insane or in the injury.
I do want to know what in America with you as president would be like, but I want to, and we keep getting off topic, my fault, because you bring up so many interesting tangents here to what we were involved in. Just to go back and finish up that meeting, September 22nd, and I understand that your memory is not the best on that, and what you do remember is that it was not a particularly emotional meeting, as some felt it was. Could I have you, this was the oath that was taken, at least that's my understanding, and others in the group said this was it. Can you just take a look at it and tell me if that's what you remember? You could read it out loud, that's great. You're comfortable with that? You still subscribe to it?
I don't remember it, but sure sounds pretty good.
Are you at all comfortable reading it out loud?
Well, I don't know about driving the enemies into the sea yet. I would drive them out of our land if there are those wanting to spread my race.
We hereby invoke the blood covenant, declare that we are in a full state of war.
And we'll not lay down our weapons until we've driven the enemy into the sea. I would have to specify who the enemy was.
Well, the enemy, according to those who were part of the grouping that we have spoken with, the enemy to Bob Matthews was ultimately the Jew and those who would betray their race.
To me, the enemy is those who destroy that race.
And that would include
anybody that works to destroy my race. Anybody that destroys the territorial imperatives necessary to the survival.
Would that include an entire other race of people?
I don't understand your question.
Would that include an entire other race? Would that include?
I don't consider other races to be my enemy.
So you didn't agree with Matthews on that?
I didn't say that. Other races aren't the ones responsible for the murder of my race. Those are treason.
But Matthews spoke specifically about the Jew and repeatedly about the Jew, and you did not agree with that.
Well, the only difference I would say is I say Zionist Jew. What you're trying to do is take...
I'm trying to understand it, because everybody has a different take on it. I'm not trying to do anything with it. I'm trying to understand it. One person said to me, if they were a Jew, you'd kill them. You're saying...
This is absolutely part of a psychological profiling. But it's not just to be used on David Lane. This is to be used on anyone peripherally associated with David Lane and people like David Lane. That's why this information is being collected.
Saying to me something different than that. So that's all I'm trying to understand. People may have come at it with different perspectives.
I don't know how anybody can know the progress of revolution. All I know is we have to have sacrosanct territories for the preservation of our people. How it happens, I don't care.
But you set certain goals, David, in a revolution. You just don't go out with a gun and barnstorm your way through a building and survive it. I mean, you have targets. That's how you win. There's a strategy. There's an enemy, you identify and go after.
I saw no strategy laid out as that pretty neat. There was simply a commitment that we had to have a place which survived my race.
It's reflecting back. Yeah. Sorry,
I would prefer to only read the words that I have.
I understand that. No, and I understand that. I didn't know if that had brought it back to you and you felt passionate
about it. It sounds kind of generic. But I only take responsibility for what I write.
Okay. When you look at these words now, and you said, well, they sound good, what do they mean when you're looking at these words?
It means that there are still a few white men that care about the highest law of nature, the preservation of their own time.
Did you need that barracks that might believe in you were embarking on something important?
No, I didn't realize there was going to be something. Well, some of them might. You say you may. Before I got into it clear, I can't speak for anybody.
Fair enough, you're right. And you've made it perfectly clear. Did you leave that meeting believing that you were about to embark on a great nation. But it's
none
wonderful
like that. Such a concept never even occurred to me. I had attended, I said, penetrated a dozen or more organizations. And here's some more rhetoric. I didn't know it was going to be more than rhetoric. I did not yet know that Bob Matthews was the kind of man he was, or that his followers would be the kind of men that he had done. But that's all in the future somewhere.
So at that meeting, you didn't even have that feeling yet about Bob?
No, he was a nice young man.
When did you realize that it was more than rhetoric?
She's trying to extract incriminating information from him here, too, as well. She's not going to succeed, but she's trying. She's trying very hard. Because, you know, if they can get more information out, they can always apply new charges. And David knows he's not going to say shit to him if he knows something more, but he's trying to know what did you know and when did you know it and who did you know, who knew what and who was doing this and who was doing that. And they're trying to extract more information that can be used to apply bigger charges, deeper charges on people that were associated, peripherally associated, people maybe that weren't even associated, but they want them to declare them associated. They're really quite a thing.
I realized it was more than rhetoric for Bob when he finally convinced himself to break the first of the old government's so-called laws. He went to he removed some of the folks' funds from the usurious vaults of the Seattle Ranch. I'll say.
Well, actually, first he robbed a porno shop if you want to know what
I mean. Oh, I think I did hear that at the trial, but I had no knowledge of that. He told me personally about taking that bank in Seattle.
What did he say to you about it? I think he was smiling.
When you first...
He broke them off.
No British fighter ever committed a crime. In the eyes of nature, in the eyes of nature's God, or any rational judgment of morality.
Wait, David. Walking into a bank with a gun and saying...
He's saying none of what they did was actually a crime in terms of natural law. May have been a crime in terms of the state, authorities, but not natural law. Interesting.
Stick them up, give me your money, whatever the words were. That's not, in your estimation, a crime?
When you're raised is over the abyss, it's extinction. Then anybody that supports the system just destroys your race.
But then that's everybody, essentially.
You notice that the Reuters did not, were not alleged and charged. You're leading me down the garden path.
Well, I am not. I wouldn't even know how to find it in this place. I don't think there is a garden path.
Well, boy.
You're going there by yourself, sir.
I don't believe that there was any allegations that the group removed any money from private parties, because they gave them in Federal Reserve funds.
So as long as it was an institution of the government, quote unquote, that is not a...
Particularly an institution that carries on usury. Usury, that is the charging of interest, is simply high crime. It is theft by deception and destroyed, and it destroys the moral fabric of the nation. And theft under color of law is the worst of all.
Did you think what Bob Matthews had done by going into that bank and removing it of some of its funds? You used much better language than I'm using right now. You think, good for you, Bob. Okay, was that a great bit of news when you heard it?
Any act that contravenes your race-murdering government, it holds my offensive.
So you enjoyed the fact that Matthew's thinking about the fact that that millennium.
I don't think that's a sufficient word.
Not strong enough, but I am. So pick another word. You'll never use another word.
That's a good enough word. That's a good enough
word. But at that point, you realize, at least for Bob Matthews, it was not rhetoric.
Correct.
In the barracks.
Correct.
Did it make you want to more than ever join forces with him? Was it a sense that, hey, we...
You know, I've always felt what Max Sapp was a philosopher. The glory, the honor of the Brooders goes to the young men of action. Philosophers are a dime a dozen. Men of action. Makes things happen in this world.
So what was your role then?
I really didn't have much to, you know, to my shame. I really didn't have much.
Well, tell me what you
did. Role.
As limited as it was, what were you going to make?
Where's that federal prosecutor you want to talk for? We won't discuss that.
Did you ever recommend to Matthews that the group get involved in County Kidding?
I do not discuss
a political laundry Charlie McGraw's
coming.
Charlie is special offer. Charlie makes your farm. Back to Charlie.
I'm sorry. I want to give allow you the opportunity to ask the question. Did you ever discuss with Bob Matthews the idea of counterfeiting?
Let's set a basis if you're going to start talking about allegations of the government. All right? I have given you or your producer absolute, undeniable proof that this government engaged in a criminal conspiracy to destroy me, that they jeopardized me 3 times. 2 districts, and absolute, undeniable mockery of the 5th and 6th Amendments to the United States Constitution. You can write to the Seattle District Court and get a copy of a pertinent indictment jeopardizing me for a crime that happened in Denver, Colorado. In violation of the 6th Amendment. That was the 1st indictment. You can write to Seattle to get a copy of the indictment jeopardizing me for conspiracy to commit an offense in Denver. That's a direct violation of the 5th Amendment. You can then write to the Denver District Court and get a copy of the indictment jeopardizing me for the same offense the 3rd time in a complete mockery of the Constitution.
And the fact that the court listened to this argument on appeal and drew it out, we know how to do it.
What does it mean to you? When they write right in the document, what does the English language mean? They write right in the document denying appeal. We tried him in Seattle for this offense. We tried him in Denver for this offense. We decided that's not double jeopardy. That just goes to show what kind of obscenity the injustice system in your government is. And if you do not realize that when operating under color of law, it's criminals masquerading as prosecutors and judges, make a blatant mockery of the fundamental law of the land, you do not realize that they will also make up charges, create perjured testimony in order to get rid of a political opponent. First of all, I think you need psychiatric counseling. But second of all, you have no consent.
I can, but not today.
What was his name?
A whole other ugly story to get into. I understand your argument. I understand what you're saying.
It is absolute fact. It is undeniable.
I'm sorry.
It is your reality.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
Right. Was the group involved in counterfeiting Avi to further the mission?
Let me put it this way. I will not discuss allegations of these federal criminals. But if the group was engaged in revolutionary activity, shall we say, why not?
So if you had been involved in counterfeiting, that would be okay. But you're not going to tell me whether you were involved in counterfeiting.
That's a good way to put it, yes.
In fact, would you be proud to have been involved in counterfeiting?
Well, I would have done. If I had been running the show and it happened, it would have been done much more. Let's forget that.
No, what was that?
Yes, I would be proud.
What was that? It would have been done much more fun. Was that pretty sloppy?
Well, a man named Murky was the problem. But, yeah.
Even before Murky, there was a problem with the bills that were not
paid
very well.
I don't want to get into them, but just see, you're starting to repeat allegations of federals and mark me from
But you know what? They're not just allegations of federals, they're also what order members or members of the group have said to me.
If an order member says he was involved himself to you in a revolutionary activity, but don't ask me to say what.
No, I'm asking you if you were, since you have been connected to it, and others in the group said, sure,
I don't admit to anything. I don't admit to any allegations of your federal government, and I will tell you that some allegations of your federal government are headquarters.
That's the best way. Don't ever admit to any allegations of anything. Especially federal government, that's for sure. You know, that's like 101 stuff. You can't be doing that. And they're trying to do that. They're trying to get him to admit to something so that they can say, oh, see, he confessed. Conspiracy charges are a very real thing. There are people doing decades in prison just for talking. It's not a joke.
If you believe, and I sense that you do believe, very strongly in the mission. And in doing what it takes.
What it takes for the survival of my race and the face of a government whose singular intent is to exterminate my race.
Then why not admit to anything you did that furthered that cause? What do you care if it's illegal or not? Because you don't honor the laws of the land anyhow. You don't believe in them.
Not only am I not going to open myself for further prosecution, I am not going to open the doors to the federals possibly prosecuting or murdering any more of my friends or associates or family.
Well, how many more years could you catch? You're not going to have. What did they
She's going to be like, well, what else could you lose, Goy? Well, okay, here's the problem, though. Like, even if she's right in a sense, it's like, well, she doesn't know. I mean, and you know, they don't. Like, he doesn't know. Like, nobody knows. Like, you could have a total changeover of the government. You could have some kind of a pardon come down. You could have an appeal go through. You would never want to do that. And he knows this. I mean, he's not going to say anything to her, but... You know, she's trying to be like, well, what do you have to lose? Just tell us all the bad things you did against the government. It's like, yeah, okay. I don't think so. I'm not admitting to nothing. Yeah. Smart.
Based on the number of
it isn't me. I don't care if they give me 10,000 years for executing a mob. I'll call your government the most filthy institution in the history of the planet. But there are other people involved.
And your concern is that in some way you could implicate others or they might be taken care of by the government?
After you sat through a federal trial, you pretty soon realize that if you say anything that ends up crucifying somebody. You simply have no conception of what this government is. You should have. Do you remember for 51 days how your media, I don't know if it was ABC, but national media, told the American people how David Koresh made the statement that he was God? I know that thousands of tapes have been sent to the national media showing how that came about. Somebody accused him of getting his wife pregnant. It turned out the lady was 74 years old. And David Koresh said, as a joke, well, I guess if he could mark up a 74-year-old lady, he was God. They looked at Captain Tate, he was God.
That's such a great point, though, right? They do this all the time. They cut out the context. They get a little clip of something. This is why I rail against this. This is why I say that anybody that does this is your enemy. They are the enemy. They are the enemy of our interests. They are the same thing as the big enemy. Anybody that's taking little clips and they're cutting things out of context and they're making shit up, that's the enemy. The first time I was really introduced to that, where do you think I first saw that technique used? Ah, right, Antifa. You know, the Jewish Communist Terror Organization. Yeah, those people. I don't care who does it. I don't care what ideology they profess. I don't care how long they claim that they've hung around the whatever they're calling it this week. Sorry, if you do that, as far as I'm concerned, you're the same as these people. I don't have any use for you. We don't have any use for you. Because why? Because you can't be trusted. Because you're not an honest person. Fundamentally, like deep down, you're not an honest person. You won't be. Ever. Probably. But we don't need to stick around to find out if you'll ever shape up and fly right. That's all there is to it. This is something that I first saw them do in the media a lot. I've seen it my whole life, really. And it's something that I usually saw them do to like bigger figures, like the Trump-type people. You know, like where he said the very fine people on both sides. He wasn't even defending the white nationalist or national socialist or white identitarian people at Charlottesville. He wasn't. He wasn't defending them at all. He was said that there were very fine people on both sides of the argument, the debate, as it were, of whether to keep the statue up or to take it down, i.e. both sides. And of course, they take a little clip of it. They snip it out of context. They tell their own story on top of what he said. Before you know it, all this time later, they'll still run with that to this day. In other words, it's a snake move. People pulling snake moves, treat them like they're a fucking hazard, because they are. And if it's not something little like this, it'll be something much bigger later. We have all kinds of people doing this sort of shit. And over all kinds of stupid grievances, too. Years ago, when the NJP was still a concern, I saw a screenshot of an Antifa Twitter post. And it said that most of the information that Antifa gets is actually provided by the, as they put it, neo-Nazis.
Right.
Basically coming to rat each other out to the actual fucking enemy as soon as their feelings were hurt, as soon as they had one little beef with somebody else. At the time, I laughed that off. I said, there's no way. That's stupid. These lying commies, these lying Jewish commies, I don't care what they're making that shit up. Come on. No, now I know they weren't lying. Of course they weren't lying. Now I know for sure they weren't lying. You got a whole chat room full of them over there on Rumble right now. That's who these people are. They can't be trusted. They can't help you. They have nothing to offer you. They're a threat. And there will always be a threat. They're not your brothers. They're not here to help you in the struggle. They don't care about the struggle. They care about whatever their self-aggrandizing fucking agenda is today. That's it. Yep. Yeah. Dux Fuhrer said, Matt Hale and David Lane and others are the Rudolph Hesses of the USA. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison. That's a pretty good comparison. All right, we're about wrapped up here anyway here.
And your media played it for 51 days to demonize the Paris Department of Slaughter. Your media does not focus on the FBI using loudspeakers, comments like, how's your breakfast, Mrs. Speaker? Are you having a nice day, Mrs. Speaker?
I don't want to
broadcasting a picture.
Please. Sure.
That's the end. That's David Lane in the end there. All right, let's go ahead and put it back to here, and we're going to go ahead and do thank yous, and we'll wrap up here because we are a little bit over where I wanted to be on time. All right, let's just do thank yous here. Where is this thing? First, start with Annie Waffen. Salute to you, Annie Waffen. All right. Klesha. Salute to you, Klesha. Wow, we really got an inversion today, huh, on these. Opposite of the usuals now. All right. Shalom. It's back down here. Okay. Odyssey. Let's see. Of course, it freezes up while I'm just trying to read out the thank yous. Such a... So funny, some people complain about this not working anymore. It's like, why do you care? This hasn't worked for years. Okay, BMC 1488, but the 88, the real 88, the right 88. Political Bomb, Tom, T-S-E-Y-M-K 77, and Chain Reaction. Big salute to you all. Thank you for supporting this show. Our short but sweet deep dive into Mr. David Lane. Very powerful person. Very powerful person. It would have been nice to have been able to have more materials from him. But, yeah, he disappeared to the gulag. That's what they do. That's what they do. That's their whole thing, right? Make you disappear. 14th Column says, thanks, Nick. Well, thank you, 14th Column. Salute to you. All right, I think that's everybody. I think that's everything. I'll thank you all very much for turning out and for supporting the show. I thank you once more. With that, we'll see you guys next time. Good night. Good night! Good night, everybody! I see you, Political Bomb. Missed you, man.
We are here to help decode your world.